Today's reading will be coming from Leviticus 23, which can be found on page 91 of the Red Pew Bible in front of you, or through your phone. Yeah. So it's page 91. The Lord said to Moses, "Speak to the Israelites and say to them, 'These are my appointed feasts, the appointed feasts of the Lord, which you are to proclaim as sacred assemblies. There are 6 days when you may work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of rest, a day of sacred assembly. You are not to do any work. Wherever you live, it is a Sabbath to the Lord. These are the Lord's appointed feasts, a sacred assembly you are to proclaim at the appointed times. The Lord's Passover begins at twilight, on the 14th day of the first month. On the 5th day of that month, the Lord's Feast of Unleavened Bread begins. For 7 days, you must eat bread made without yeast. On the 1st day, hold a sacred assembly and do no regular work. For 7 days, present an offering made to the Lord by fire. And on the 7th day, hold a sacred assembly and do no regular work." The Lord said to Moses, "Speak to the Israelites and say to them, 'When you enter the land I am going to give you and you reap its harvest, bring to the priest a sheaf of first grain you harvest. He is to wave this sheaf before the Lord, so it will be accepted on your behalf. The priest is to wave it on the day after the Sabbath. On the day you wave the sheaf, you must sacrifice as a burnt offering to the Lord, a lamb a year old without defects, together with its grain offering of 2/10 of the ephah of the fine flour mixed with oil, an offering made to the Lord by fire, a pleasing aroma, and its drink offering of 1/4 of a hin of wine. You must not eat any bread or rolls or new grain until the very day you bring this offering to your God. This is to be a lasting ordinance for the generations to come, wherever you live. From the day after the Sabbath, the day you brought the sheaf of wave offering, count off 7 full weeks. Count off 50th day up to the day after the seventh Sabbath, and then present an offering of new grains to the Lord. From wherever you live, bring 2 loaves made of 2/10 of the even of fine flour, baked with yeast, as a wave offering of first fruit to the Lord. Present with this bread 7 male lambs, each a year old and without defects, 1 young bull and 2 rams. They will be a burnt offering to the Lord, together with the grain offering and drink offering, an offering made by fire, an aroma pleasing to the Lord. Then sacrifice 1 male goat of a sin offering and 2 lambs, each a year old, for a fellowship offering. The priest is to wave the 2 lambs before the Lord as a wave offering, together with a bread of the first fruit. They are a sacred offering to the God of for the priest. On the same day, you are to proclaim a sacred assembly and do no regular work. This is to be a lasting ordinance for the generation to come, wherever you live. When you reap the harvest of your land, do not reap to the very edge of your field or gather the gleaning of your harvest. Leave them for the poor and the alien. I am the Lord your God." The Lord said to Moses, "Say to the Israelites, on the 1st day of the 7th month, you are to have a day of rest, a sacred assembly, commemorated with trumpet blast. Do no regular work, but present an offering made to the Lord by fire." The Lord said to Moses, "The 10th day of the 7th month is the day of atonement. Hold a sacred assembly and deny yourself, and present an offering made to the Lord by fire. Do no work on that day, because it's the day of atonement. When atonement is made for you before the Lord your God, anyone who does not deny himself on that day must be cut off from his people. I will destroy from among his people anyone who does any work on that day. You shall do no work at all. It is to be a lasting ordinance for the generation to come, wherever you live. It is a Sabbath of rest for you, and you must deny yourself. From the evening of the 9th of day of the month until the following evening, you are to observe your Sabbath." The Lord said to Moses, Say to the Israelites, On the 15th day of the 7th month, the Lord's feast of the tabernacle begins, and it lasts for 7 days. The first day is a sacred assembly. Do no regular work. For 7th day, present an offering made to the Lord by fire. And on the 8th day, hold a sacred assembly and present an offering made to the Lord by fire. This is the closing assembly. Do no regular work. These are the Lord's appointed feasts, which you are to proclaim as sacred assemblies, for bringing offering made to the Lord by fire, the burnt offering and the grain offering, sacrifice and drink offering, required for each day. These offerings are in addition to those for the Lord's Sabbath and in addition to your gift, and whatever you have vowed, and all the freewill offering you give to the Lord. So beginning with the 15th day of the 7th month, after you have gathered the crops of the land, celebrate the festival to the Lord for 7th day. The first day is a day of rest, and the 8th day is also a day of rest. On the first day, you are to take choice fruit from the trees, and palm fruit, and leafy branch, and poplars, and rejoice before the Lord your God for 7th day. Celebrate this as a festival to the Lord for 7th day each year. This is to be a lasting ordinance for the generation to come. Celebrate it in the 7th month. Live in booth for 7th day. All native-born Israelites are to live in a booth. So your descendants will know that I had the Israelites live in booth when I brought them out of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. So Moses announced to the Israelites the appointed feast of the Lord.
Thanks, Jonathan. Well, who can remember those, who can forget those immortal words? Are we there yet? Do you remember who said that? Who said it? Who was that famous philosopher who said that? Are we there yet? Come on. No, Bart Simpson? No, it was Donkey. In Shrek, I think it was Shrek 2. Are we there yet? And for the last few months, we've been certainly travelling through the book of Leviticus, and the big question, are we there yet? Are we at the end yet? And no doubt for some of us, it may have been a torturous journey. I hope it at least has shed some light. But as I said at the beginning, I think that for many noble travellers who tried to go from beginning to end, we invariably die on the plains of the deserts of Leviticus, or get hypoxia as we climb the heights of Leviticus. But if we survive that trek up, get across the plains, you get a perspective of the whole Bible which is second to none. The book of Leviticus really stands in a league of its own in terms of helping us understand the whole Bible. It is, you could say, provides a shape for the Bible. It provides the background for the Bible. It gives us a depth of understanding which I think to a large degree many other books of the Old Testament is matchless. And it's interesting that later on in the year we'll be looking at the book of Hebrews. And when you look through the book of Hebrews, there you could say it's the end destination of what Leviticus is pointing to. Just to recap, Leviticus is simply divided into halves, right? With the peak at Leviticus chapter 16. And you could say that the whole book of Leviticus is really about holiness. The first half of the book of Leviticus, from chapters 1 through to 15, is about how a person can come into the presence of God both safely and joyfully. And the answer is there through sacrifices, through priesthood, through being made new. And really the whole focus is not so much what they do, it's about what God, it's a pathway which God lays out before them. He calls upon them that it's through sacrifice, not through good works, but through sacrifices. He talks about the fact it comes through priesthood. You can't come by yourself, it has through priesthood. And then lastly, right, it speaks of also of the regenerating work that God needs to do in us. That's how a person comes into the presence of God, through sacrifice, through a priest, and through internal regeneration. The first half points to all that. The second half points, you could say, to the implications of what it means to have come into the presence of God. You could say the second half are very much like house rules. You pay the fees to go into a hotel or to retreat, and then the person tells you, you're here, welcome here to enjoy your stay. These are the house rules. And so the second half really focuses on what it means to now live in the presence of God. And the big sort of catchphrase is to be holy as God is holy. And you looked at verses 17 onwards, really looks at the life of the people of God, looks at the purity of the priests. And now it wraps up what reminding us of very important fundamental truths that and symbols, which 23 to 27 now zeroes in. Because of time, we don't have a lot of detail. We don't have a lot of time to zip into a lot of detail. For that reason, I commend to you Jack's lectures that will come up. And there he'll probably go into a little more detail than I can ever do. But here is just it's a sort of 40,000 feet travel over the plains of Leviticus. And so I'm going to be very fast, look at just little bits, but we can't go into the details. But I would commend to you, one reason we're doing this is to, you could say, encourage you in your own Bible reading, not to be a substitute for it. There are four things I want to talk about today, very briefly. One, what does it mean to live the holy life? One, it's marked by joy in what God has done for us. Two, marked by fear about the holiness of God. Three, it's about obedience to the commands of God. And fourthly, it's a reminder about the cost of worshiping God. So joy, fear, obedience, and cost. Let's have a look at joy. The first chapters 23 and 25, zeroes in on some very key appointed holidays in the life of Israel. You can see that in the headings there. Very fortunately, the NIV have sort of broken it down to us and talks about forced appointed holidays in the life of Israel. You can see that in 23. There's the Sabbath on page 91. There is the Passover and unleavened bread, the first fruits, the Feast of Weeks, trumpets, Day of Atonement, and Feast of Tabernacles, right? As I said, I don't have a lot of time to go into what the significance of them all, but suffice to say that each of these calendar events were quite significant in the history of Israel because they pointed to key events in the history of Israel. They pointed to key things which God has done for Israel. So the Sabbath is a reminder, you could say, of God's creative work. Remember Genesis chapter 1. God created all things, he rested on the Sabbath. That was to be the Sabbath day, is a reminder of God's creative work. The Passover is about reminding them of God's rescue from them out of Egypt. First fruit is a reminder of God's provision for them when they first came into the promised land. That is, they when they begin the harvest, the first fruit is not that something they take for themselves, but something they give to God. The Feast of Weeks is at the end of the harvest. The first fruits of beginning, the first of weeks is the end of harvest, and is again a recounting of God's good provision for the people of Israel. The Feast of Trumpets is the annual ceremony where they blow the trumpet, and in the ancient history, that was a reminder of who they were. It's a call, you could say, to stop and reflect on what God has done and who they are. And the Day of Atonement was the peak, remember in the book of Leviticus, a reminder of the great work of God forgiving all our sins for that year, an event that continues to be celebrated every year where God washes their sins and forgives them for everything they've done. And lastly, the Feast of Tabernacles or the Feast of Booth is the time in the year when they would live in homemade tents. And again, it's a reminder that when God pulled them out of Egypt, they wandered in the desert and they were living in tents. It's a reminder of their pilgrimage from slavery to the promised land. Each of these events, like you could say Anzac Day and Australia Day, is a reminder, a very powerful reminder of all that God has done for them. But it didn't stop there. If you look at chapter 25, it speaks of two very key events there. These are quite unusual, quite second to none, because we all have our annual holidays, but this is a year holiday, the Sabbath year. Look at the Sabbath year in chapter 25. When you enter the land I am going to give you in verse 2, the land itself must observe a Sabbath to the Lord. For 6 years, sow your fields, and for 6 years, prune your vineyards and gather their crops. But in the seventh year, the land is to have a Sabbath rest, a Sabbath to the Lord. Do not sow your fields or prunes or vineyards for that whole year. Astonishing practice, isn't it? They were not to do any work for the whole year. For the whole year. And it wasn't that they were not to do any work and to rest. They were to give the land a rest as well, and they were to give the animals rest as well, because the Sabbath year was a year of rest for the whole of creation, not just for people. Astonishing thought, isn't it? Practice. But it didn't and that happened every seventh year. You work for six, you rest on the seventh year. Now, how would that go if we did that in Australia? That'd be awesome, wouldn't it? Would it be awesome? Well, let's think about that. Then there's another special calendar year, which is the 50th year. So you can see there in chapter 25, verse 8, count of seven Sabbaths of year, seven times 7 years, so that the seven Sabbaths of years amount to a period of 49. Then have the trumpet sounded everywhere on the 10th day of the 7th month, on the Day of Atonement of that year, right? Consecrate the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout the land to all inhabitants. It shall be a jubilee. Each of you is to return his family property and each to his own clan. The 50th year shall be a jubilee for you. Do not sow and do not reap what grows of itself or harvest the untended vines. For it is a jubilee and is to be holy for you. Eat only what is taken directly from the year. What's the idea there? Every 50th year, the whole land is to rest. The whole land. So that's astonishing. Not only do they rest for 1 year every seventh year, but when it comes to the 49th year, they've got to rest. But the 50th year is also a year of rest. So that's 2 years of rest. But this year is a very different year, because notice what it says here in verse 10. It shall be jubilee for you. Each one of you is to return his family property and each to his own clan. It is a year of freedom and of release and restoration. That is to say that if the 50th year you have worked and you've lost your property, it get returned to you free of charge for the 50th year. If you work your butt off and now you get into debt and you sell yourself to slavery, in the 50th year, your freedom is given back to you. It is a year of everything being rebooted back. And why is that? Well, we don't have a lot of time, but what you discover here is that later on, it really is to ensure that no one in the land is in poverty. Because that's what happens in many countries, isn't it? People work their butt off, things go bad, and then they lose their property, they lose their freedom, they lose their livelihood. And in there, they've got to work their way out of it, and many of them will never be able to work their way out of it. But what God does here is implants in that calendar year, once every 50 years, a complete restoration where if anything you've lost, it gets returned to you free of charge. What is the point of all these symbols and all these holidays? And I think there's three things that are very important thing. One, it is a time to rest and enjoy. That's the first thing. It's a time to reflect, and it's a time to trust. How so? It's a time to stop and reflect. Because one of the biggest problems I find in our society today, and many of us see, is that we're so busy, none of us has time to enjoy the good things which God has given to us. It's true, isn't it? It's a funny thing, it's the irony that we're so busy earning money to pay off our house, to enjoy life, so much so that we never get a chance to enjoy it. By the time we actually enjoy it, we're too old to enjoy it. Or worse still, by the time we get to enjoy it, we have a heart attack, a stroke, get killed in a car accident, and we never get to enjoy it. It is one of the greatest tragedies of our busy lifestyle that we're so busy, we're too busy to enjoy life. Is that your problem? Because that is the new norm in our society today. We're so, so busy. You just look at all the graveyards these days. Any one of them wish they were busier at work? None of them. They wish they had more time to stop and to reflect. But here's the second thing. One of the things about these holidays you see in chapter 23 and 25 is that they were forced holidays. Why were they forced holidays? Not only forced them to stop and reflect, but forced them to enjoy. They weren't just simply rules and regulations. They were there forced to stop and to enjoy life. It's like oftentimes our family dinner. Okay, look, I don't care what you're doing. Dinner time's here to be with the family. It's a forced thing. Why is that? Not because we just want to be sort of legalistic, but because we want people to stop and enjoy being with the family. And that's what God is doing here in chapter 23 and 25. He's actually forcing them to enjoy his goodness to them. It's a funny thing, isn't it? You've got to force people to have fun. You've got to force people to enjoy things. And that's what we've got to do today. We have to, God in his wisdom has to force people to enjoy things. But lastly, it's an opportunity to trust that God is in charge. Because the big question here, in say for instance, in chapter in the Sabbath year, in sort of the Jubilee year, what does it say in Jubilee year? Let's see, in verse 16. When the year of many, you are to increase the price, blah, blah, blah. No, I can't remember. It's in there. Can anyone see that year? Oh, no, it's in there somewhere. Oh, yes, in verse 20. Where is it? My notes here. Is it in my notes here? I can't look. Oh, it's in there. Just have a look at yourself, okay? Okay, sorry about that. I had it there in my notes there. what verse? Verse 18. Verse 20. You may ask, what will we eat in the seventh year if you do not plant or harvest or crops? And note what God says. I will send you such a blessing in the sixth year that the land will yield enough for 3 years. While you plant during the eighth year, you will eat from the old crop and will continue to eat from it until the harvest of the ninth year comes in. See what God's saying there? They're going to ask, well, who's going to feed us? And God says, don't worry about that. I am the God who controls the land. I'm the one who gave you the land. This is my land. I will command the land to produce such a bounty that you won't even have to worry about working in the seventh year, in the eighth, in that the Sabbath year, and the year after that. Because I'm sure that you will be provided for. And so you could say that these Sabbath, these holidays are there to force you to stop and reflect on all that God has done for you, more precisely in his work of salvation, forgiveness, rescue. It is a time to stop you to force to enjoy God's goodness. And thirdly, it's a way to stop you to trust that God will provide for you. You know why we're so busy? Because essentially we believe that we're God. That's why we're so busy. We're God. You know, we think that if I stop working, the whole company's going to fall. If I stop working, there's not going to be food on the table. If I stop doing this, I'm not going to have a livelihood. That's ridiculous. Because the Bible says here, everything you have comes from God. And he will provide you with all that you need if only you will simply trust him. If only you will simply trust him. And so these are forced holidays are there to stop people to reflect on who God is, to enjoy who God is, and to trust in God's provision. Joy. But secondly, it's about fear. Fear the holiness of God. Fear the holiness of God. In chapter 24, you have this very interesting rule and regulations about oil for the fire, altar, and bread, which they have to cook up, place in the temple, in the tabernacle, before God as an offering, and then it's also food for the priests. But what's interesting in verses 10 onwards, where it seems to break this sort of pattern, this run, with this very unusual incident where, out of nowhere, God talks about, there's this incident of a man having a fight with another guy, and the man actually blasphemes the name of God. You have a look at verse 11. The son of the Israelite woman blasphemed the name with a curse, so they brought him... Oh, no, pick on verse 10. Now the son of an Israelite mother and an Egyptian father went out among the Israelites, and a fight broke out in the camp between him and the Israelite. The son of the Israelite woman blasphemed the name with a curse, so they brought him to Moses. And verse 12, they put him in custody until the will of the Lord should be made clear to them. And what you discover later on is that God commands this person to be executed. For what reason? Because he blasphemed the name of God. And what's the point here? The point here is very simple. You don't mess around with God. You take God seriously. You do not domesticate his name. You do not flippantly band around his name. You treat God with absolute respect. And that's the point here. That is to say that to live a holy life is to take God seriously. It is to take his holiness seriously. Fear means treating God as God should be treated. And one of the greatest danger for modern-day Christianity and the greatest danger throughout history is that we have always domesticated God, sanitized God, made God safe, but so safe that he's not dangerous and we can do whatever we like. And the point says here is, no, that's not true. If we're going to live a holy life, then it means taking God seriously, taking his name seriously. That's what it means here, and that's the point. Because we live in a very dangerous situation. We live in the very presence of God. Now, of course, as we know from the first half of Leviticus, there is always forgiveness because there's sacrifices and so on. But that being said, God is still a God. You do not treat lightly and domesticate him, etc., etc. We need to take God seriously. The holy life is marked by, you could say, a divine respect and awe of who God is. This comes out even more so when you come to chapter 26. Because in chapter 26, the whole focus here now talks about obedience and disobedience. But more specifically, it talks about the importance of obedience. Have a look at it begins in chapter 26, verses 1 and 2, right? 26 verses 1 and 2. We read these words. 26 verses 1 and 2. Do not make idols or set up an image or a sacred stone for yourselves. Do not place a carved stone in your land to bow down before. I am the Lord your God. Observe my Sabbath and have reverence for my sanctuary. I am the Lord. The whole focus here is on obedience. But what is interesting is that where obedience begins, where does obedience begin? It begins with the right knowledge and right understanding of God. That's where it begins. You know, it's interesting when people say, oh, I obey God. We talk about, do you love your neighbor as yourself, blah, 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 and so on. I haven't killed anyone, don't commit adultery. But that's not where you begin obedience. Obedience begins with the right understanding of God. Obedience begins with having a right view of God. And what is the right view of God? Well, God tells us, do not make idols for yourselves. Do not make images of God for yourselves. Do not defame, devalue the Sabbath. What was the significance of Sabbath? It was a symbol of his lordship and of his provision for us. In other words, if we truly want to obey God, it begins with getting God right. Not getting each other wrong, right. In fact, it right needs to say that to treat people correctly, you have to treat God correctly. To understand people correctly, you have to understand God correctly. You get it wrong at God, you always get it wrong with everyone else. Paul, in the book of Romans later on, picks up this idea. And what he says is that when he looks at the problems of the world, what does he see as the problem of the world? You know what the biggest problem of the world is? That people do not give thanks to God and do not honor him as God. That is the fundamental problem of the world. Their fundamental is that they have rejected what? God. They've treated him not as he deserves, right? And instead, what have they done? What does it mean not to treat God as he deserves? They make idols for themselves. They make images of God crafted in their own ideas. It's a funny thing, isn't it? You know, God tells us in Genesis 1 that he created us in his image. But what happens now is that we have created God in our own image. God has now become a social construct. God has become now very Chinese, very Asian, very Middle Eastern, very whatever. God has been created in our image. And therefore, what does it mean to treat God properly? You know what it means to treat God properly? Well, God tells us, doesn't it? Do not make idols. That's what it means to treat God properly. Do not make idols. It means do not set up an image or a sacred stone for yourselves. That's what it means to treat God properly. And so I put it to you, do you treat God properly? Do you have a right attitude towards God? Or let me put it much more concretely, what is it? What are the idols in your life? What are the things that you worship over and above God? What are the crazy ideas that you have about God? What are they? Because those idols are the things that God tells us. Because of those idols, you're not treating me as I should be treated. You're putting other things over and above me. You have these wacky ideas about me, which is not true to who I am or what I've said about myself. And so what are the current idols? Well, think about it. What are the things that we would die for? What are the things that we change our life for? What are the things that we would do anything for? Our work, our family, our kids, our lifestyle. They're not wrong in themselves unless they become gods in themselves. And so God tells us, don't worship idols. Don't make images of me. And so God calls upon them to worship him and to worship him alone. That's obedience. And what is the blessing that comes with it? Well, have a look at verses 4 onwards. Because he spells out what it looks like. In verse onward, I will send you rain in season. The ground will yield its crops and the trees of the field their fruit. Your threshing will continue until grapes harvest and a great harvest will continue until planting. Verse 6, I will grant peace in the land and you will lie down and no one will make you afraid. I will remove savage beasts from the land and the sword will not pass through you. Verse 9, I will look on you with favor and make you fruitful and increase your numbers and I will keep my covenant with you. You will be eating last year's harvest when you have to move it out to make room for the new. I will put my dwelling among you. Verse 12, I will walk among you and be your God and you'll be my people. And so on and so forth. What's he actually saying there? The key word is those who come back to God will experience the prosperous life. Prosperous life. Now, let's be careful here. When God speaks of the prosperous life, it is not equated with the crass materialism that we see now in our consumeristic society. We think about prosperity in terms of materialism. He's talking about prosperity in its real sense. Remember what Jesus once said this. He said this, life is more than food and drink. That's what everyone thinks. If I have good food, I've drink, then I've got the good life. Jesus, it's not about that. It's not about food and drink. Jesus once said to a Samaritan woman wanting water, you know that water you're going to drink? You're going to still be thirsty. I'm going to give you special water that's never going to make you thirsty again. And there was a crowd of people following Jesus because he fed them. He made a miracle and fed them bread. And Jesus said, you know, you're looking for bread. You're going to eat it and you're going to still be hungry. I tell you what, I'm going to give you bread that comes from heaven and that will satisfy you forever. Forever. Remember what Jesus said? I come that you might have life and have it to the full. And he wasn't acquainted with crass materialism, because that was the problem of many of the sort of would-be disciples of Jesus. I want this food and then you're still going to die from it. Jesus is talking about life in all its fullness and riches. And the language here in chapter 26 you could say, is a very picturesque way of describing what that new life is like. It's a life of peace, of joy, of harmony, of prosperity, a peace of without living in fear, of health. Again, do not equate that with crass materialism, but what God has given you, life in all its richness and fullness, a contentment which nothing in the world can ever offer. That is what God offers his people. But on the flip side, there's also a warning. You see this in verse 14 onwards. We don't have a lot of time to go through that. But there is a strong warning. And it's a warning for those who would turn away from God. Look at verse 16 onwards, right? Then I will do this to you. I will bring you. I'll bring upon you sudden terror, wasting disease and fever that would destroy your sight and drain away your life. You will plant seed in vain because your enemies will eat it. I will set my face against you. Verse 18. If after all this you will not listen to me, I will punish you with sin seven times over. I will break down your stubborn pride and make the skies above you like iron and the ground beneath you like bronze. Your strength will be spent in vain because your soul will not yield. In verse 21, if you remain hostile to me and refuse to listen to me, I will multiply your affliction seven times. Verse 22, I will send wild animals against you and they will rob you of your children, destroy your cattle, make you so few. You get the picture? What is God saying, warning his people they turn away from him? It's a life of disaster, devastation, of tragedy, of sorrow, or horror, of sickness, of pain, of deep, deep darkness. That is what God is warning those. And when you think about it, that's what the Bible is always constantly warning. In fact, Romans chapter 1, Paul tells us that when people have turned away from God, what is God's response? He's angry and brings condemnation in the world. And when you look at the Word, if we have an opportunity to look at what life is really like, which we'll go through in the book of Ecclesiastes, when you look at life, what's really like, you see a world that's broken. You see relationships broken. You see sickness and fever, and you see famine, you see oppression, like we see with the book of, with compassion. We see all that sort of thing all around the world. And what's that all a sign of? It's a sign that we live in a world where God is angry with the world overall. Death and disease and destruction is rampant right over the world. And we might not feel that, but the warning of Scripture is that what we might experience in a small part now is nothing compared to the hell that awaits people who ultimately turn away from him. Here's a warning. But there is a word of hope there, even in the midst of that warning. Because what does God say to them? Because even in the midst of that warning, he calls upon them to turn back to him. So Leviticus 26, verse 40, we read these words. Verse 40. But if they will confess their sins and the sins of their fathers, their treachery against me and their hostility toward me, which made me hostile toward them, so that I sent them into the land of their enemies, then when their uncircumcised hearts are humbled and they pay for their sins, I will remember my covenant with Jacob and my covenant with Isaac and my covenant with Abraham, and I will remember the land. To reference that here, God will offer, there's always offer forgiveness for those who'd come back to him. But the point here is that live a holy life is a life of obedience. Obedience that results in a prosperous life. A life of joy, fullness. Not necessarily a material richness, but a deep richness that the world can never offer. But lastly, we come to chapter 27. Chapter 27 is a strange section to end off because one would have thought you finish off in chapter 26, but instead you end off at 27. And 27 really is a focus on people want to make promises to God, and so I want to dedicate my servant, I want to get my son, I want to dedicate my house, my land to you. And the point here is that therefore, okay, you want to dedicate, let's assess the value of that, what you're going to offer, and that money you give to God. That really is the sum total of what chapter 27 is about. But what's the whole idea of chapter 27? Really, the big idea is that for all that God has said about the call to be holy, the call to live a holy life is a costly call. It will cost you what? Everything. Salvation is free, but to live that holy life is a call to give up everything for God. Remember what Jesus once said? You know, if you want to follow me, you've got to be prepared to love me more than you love your most dearly beloved wife or husband. You want to love me and follow me, you've got to be willing to love me over and above your children. If you want to actually follow me, you've got to be willing to follow me and to love me over and above your work. In fact, if you want to call me Lord, you've got to be prepared to love me over and above your own life. And Jesus said this, whoever holds their life, holds so tightly on their life, will eventually lose it. But whoever loses their life in this world to gain the eternal life will receive that eternal life when Jesus returns here. That is to say, it is a very apt way to finish the book of Leviticus, because chapter 1 to 7 talked about the cost of coming into the very presence of God. And chapter 27, you could say, talks about the cost of living in the presence of God. And that is to say that the call to live a holy life really is a call to give up all things and to give all things to God. We are called to follow Him at all costs, which in many cases and in all cases will cost us everything. Will cost us everything. I remember the time when I had to make that difficult decision to become a Christian. And it was at the anger, despite the anger of my parents, to follow Jesus. But even then, when I had to give that decision to actually follow Jesus into full-time ministry, it was despite the anger of my parents that I went into it. It was a painful cost. Now, I don't know what's going to cost you. Whatever it is to follow Jesus, to love Him, to treat Him as Lord, is in the end something that will cost you your whole life. And that's why chapter 27 is in many ways an apt way to conclude the book of Leviticus that speaks about the holy life. Let me wrap it up in the next minute. The book of Leviticus, it's all about holiness. The great majesty of the book of holiness, the book of Leviticus, it reminds us, how do we come into the presence of God? How do we come into it safely? And when you look to the New Testament, we come in safely, not through great things that we've done, but what God has done for us in the Lord Jesus. He is our sacrifice, our high priest. But lastly, right, we now wrap it up by saying that He now, having been saved, He now calls us to live a holy life fully to Him. Let me pray. Thanks, Father in heaven, that You have saved us. Help us to now live lives that are pleasing to You in all things. In Jesus' name.
Now this brings us to a close of service. Just a few housekeeping things before we go. There is lunch upstairs, so let's continue our gathering over a meal. It's free if it's your first time, or $5. Lunch is a great way to get to know people at sea.